welcome to Inside Scoop Live. I'm Irene Watson, and I am your host for today and sitting in for our regular host, Juanita Watson. Today, I'm really delighted to be speaking on the phone with Nikolai Shevchuk, and he is from Russia. Nikolai is actually the author of a newly published book, How to Become Smarter. Now, he is a Russian-born biologist who actually came to the United States in 1999, and he got his PhD degree in molecular and cellular oncology from the George Washington University, and that was in 2006. Nikolai is an author or a co-author of 15 scientific publications, and he is currently working at a biotech company in Novosibirsk, Russia. His interest is actually in neuroscience, and it began with investigating the effects of cooling on mood and fatigue. And this is something that we will be talking about, which actually then led his interest in the effects of dietary changes on the various brain functions. And this book, How to Become Smarter, actually summarizes his research and personal observations over the 17 years. Hi, Nikolai. Welcome.
Hi, Erin.
It's so great to talk to you and all the way from Russia. It really gives me a pleasure. And what I'm really excited about is talk about this book because, gosh, you know, here in the United States, our society is finally getting a grip on what works in diet. And, you know, our country is so highly obese and we're finally making a shift. So you're certainly a forerunner with your information. And I know that our listeners I'm just going to be really thrilled to hear what you have to say because some of this is very cutting edge. So welcome.
Thanks.
Now, I want to, as I mentioned earlier, the name of the book is How to Become Smarter. And, gosh, we certainly, that's one thing that we certainly want to do, and I know that you'll be giving us a lot of tips on how that can happen. So tell me, first of all, before we get into the really, you know, down-to-earth stuff that can help us, how did you get interested in writing a book like this?
I was interested in various diets for, I don't know, 16 or 17 years. And just from my personal experience, I noticed that some dietary changes can affect your mental functions in some ways. And this has been just personal observation for me for a good long of this period, and I only started to put some scientific touches on this and finding some scientific basis for my observations only relatively recently. But the first interesting thing that got me working in this direction, doing some real hard research, is the effect of cooling on mood, fatigue, and other mental functions. And after I published some theoretical papers on this topic, I decided to dig deeper and try to find the scientific basis for the dietary changes that I've been using practically for some time. And I found some stuff, and I put all this together and wrote up the book, and now it's ready.
That's great. Well, you know, our human brain has evolved for, what, 15 million years, and you know, going back to 15 million years ago, we're certainly different than what we are now. And so let's just talk a little bit about the evolution. You know, what really 15 million years ago, what was the diet and what was the function of the brain at that time as compared to what it is now and how it functions? Just explain that to our listening audience.
In a nutshell, it can be said that the brain was much smaller 15 million years ago. This is the time that the great apes or hominids first appeared, which is the combined ancestors of humans, chimpanzees, and gorillas. And hominids, which is the ancestors of humans and chimpanzees, appeared much later, and the Homo sapiens, per se, appeared approximately 100,000 years ago. But the really sophisticated cooking methods did not enter human practice until about 300,000 years ago, which is the recorded time of the first use of fire for cooking. And the various fossil data and etc., they suggest that prior to that, humans mostly consumed meat, maybe fish, and raw fruits and vegetables. So it was just a 100% raw diet, free of any artificial ingredients such as seasonings, salad dressings, food additives, etc., etc. The first use of salt, for example, was only recorded approximately 6,000 years ago. So this is 300,000 years ago. This is probably the diet that roughly corresponds to the modern diet of chimpanzees, which mostly consists of raw plant food and raw meat on occasion. So this is basically the ancestral diet of humans, according to the currently available data.
So is there anything available? Why did people start cooking? I realize, you know, the fire, of course, and, you know, all these things that fire can do besides provide heat. So why do you think at that time, like 300,000 years ago is a long time, so why do you think at that time is there really any data that shows as to why people started cooking at that time?
It's not clear why, and I'm not exactly an expert on this topic. There's a great researcher, Renkham, I forget the first name.
Mm-hmm.
He investigated this topic very exhaustively. The properties of cooked meat, of raw meat, how it affects the brain, and there's a theory that the cooking is probably responsible for the rapid growth of the brain size in humans.
Ah.
But basically, yes, it's not proven.
Uh-huh.
It's not proven, but there is a theory which goes along these lines. But basically, the best I can tell you is that humans just started experimenting with various ways of preparing food and making it tastier. And recent experiments on chimpanzees show that chimpanzees prefer cooked food, cooked meat, over raw meat, even though raw meat is their natural food, but they still find cooked meat tastier in the laboratory, and cooked vegetables and fruits, etc. So cooking, it just made food tastier, and this is probably what got people hooked on it.
Interesting. Interesting concept. I'm going to have to do a little more research on that because that interests me. So, Nikolai, let's go further into your research. And you have found that it is possible to control the brain functions, you know, things like sleep or mood or activity levels, emotions, all that kind of stuff, without using drugs, but using food instead. So let's just kind of go into that direction and tell our listening audience about your research and what you really did find and what you do know.
The existing data, some of it is just my personal observations, which are not supported by any existing evidence.
Uh-huh.
A good half of it is probably pre-existing scientific evidence, so it's kind of a mixed bag. But I can tell you that there is plenty of evidence that, for example, cooked meat tends to lower mood in humans. Both diets that consist of lots of cooked meat and even a single meal that consists of roasted chicken and eggs was shown to noticeably lower mood in humans. So that's one way of controlling mood, so to speak, if you need to lower mood, and there are some situations where you need to do that.
So maybe when you're talking about turkey, for instance, there's so much tryptophan in it. So, of course, that alters the mood, doesn't it? People get tired after their Thanksgiving dinner here.
Yes.
So is that what you're talking about?
It affects the it's a little bit more complicated than that. If you compare a raw ground turkey, yeah, which is not recommended because it carries a risk of infectious disease, but it can be done in certain controlled conditions. If you compare the effects of raw turkey and cooked turkey, my research suggests that uncooked meat tends to improve mood, reduce fatigue, and while cooked meat tends to have the opposite effects. It may slightly increased fatigue and slightly lower mood. And my book goes into details as to why this may be the case. Uh-huh. But both types of food is they are the source of very high quality protein, and both types of food seem to improve attention and impulse control, and they may increase the alertness as well. So the connection with tryptophan is not a good example, because very high protein diets such as the Atkins diet, contains lots of meat and tryptophan, nonetheless, they tend to decrease the amount of sleep, at least initially, for the first few weeks when people go on these diets. So I wouldn't link tryptophan here. It's a complicated issue, because there's lots of other stuff in meat besides tryptophan. And one other interesting point, tryptophan is the precursor of serotonin made in your brain.
Yeah.
And it is widely believed that the more serotonin you have in your brain, the better the mood should be. But actually, there's plenty of evidence that this is not the case, and the relationship of serotonin with mood and depression is much more complicated than that. And more serotonin does not necessarily mean better mood, and less serotonin does not mean worse mood, and so on. It's a very complicated issue.
Yes, I believe that. So as you're talking, and you're talking about the raw meat, you know, I love sushi. And when I go to a restaurant that serves really good sushi, clean sushi, I just really feel good. My body feels good, and especially if I have sashimi, because that's basically raw, good fish, and I just feel really charged.
The my book explains why the raw protein, I provide some safe sources of raw protein, except raw meat and fish. For example, unsalted and unprocessed cheese mixed with cultured milk is an excellent source of raw protein, and it's safe. It doesn't carry a risk of infectious disease, as opposed to raw meat, for example. But the effects are very similar.
Okay.
When you consume a lot of raw protein, this tends to improve mood immediately, reduce fatigue, you feel more energetic, and the experiments in laboratory mice suggest that raw high-protein diets, they tend to have similar effects to central nervous system stimulants. Animals become more active, they're less sluggish, they're more energetic. If we're talking about predators, they become more aggressive and active. And so the effects are very similar, and the chemical changes in the brain are also similar. For example, such stimulants as amphetamine, they tend to increase the level of a chemical called dopamine in some areas of the brain, some brain regions, and the same was reported for high-protein diets in laboratory animals, so the effects are pretty similar between the psychostimulant drugs and high-protein diets, especially raw high-protein diets. This is what has been shown in laboratory animals. And with respect to attention particularly, there's evidence some human subjects that high-protein meals can significantly improve attention in the laboratory, attention function, which is also similar to the effects of amphetamine-like stimulants, which are known to improve attention both in patients and in healthy people.
You know, I so believe that, Nikolai. Just, you know, I have a dog and a cat, and I feed them raw chicken, good organic, you know, no chemicals, no additives, no steroids, and such a difference in them, and I really believe that. So it's no different in animals than it is in humans. So we're talking about meat. Now, what about the vegetarian? How does the vegetarian get a high-protein diet that would have the same effect?
As I mentioned, the mixture of unsalted, unprocessed cheese with cultured milk can be an excellent source of raw protein in a vegetarian diet. I'm not sure about vegan diet.
Yeah.
And the evidence from our ancestors and the structure of the human digestive tract and that of the chimpanzees, our closest genetic relatives, suggest that humans are not vegetarians by nature. They are supposed to consume animal food along with plant food. They are omnivores. They are not frugivores or vegetarians. They are not carnivores. They are omnivores. They have a digestive tract that is intermediate between that of vegetarian species and carnivorous species. So this is what the current science suggests.
I thought in my case, Nikolai, I am dairy intolerant. My body cannot digest. Something happened along the way here, and this is something that I need to that I am working on. So therefore, I cannot have the unprocessed cheese or unprocessed milk, which is available to us here. But I'm not able to do that. So, and I know that there are many others. And so, what do you suggest for those of us that are dairy intolerant?
I think there's evidence that if you consume cultured milk or culture such as kefir or buttermilk that is free of any artificial ingredients, the amount of lactose is dramatically reduced there because it's broken down by bacteria. And if you consume relatively small amounts of cultured milk instead of milk, this should be tolerated better, at least in theory. I read about this. But I don't know how it works in practice. Have you had any experience with that?
Yeah, it doesn't work for me. So what I switched to, which really works, is coconut milk. And coconut fur is wonderful. It works. The coconut milk is widely used now. It's really coming into the forefront here with many people. And it has a lot of good properties, and that's what works for me anyway.
It probably it's a good source of protein.
Yes.
But I would still add at least small amounts of cooked flesh, such as...
Oh, definitely, yes.
Because the plant protein, it's been shown in many experiments, the quality of plant protein is much lower than that from the animal source. Mm-hmm. For example, if you feed laboratory rats plant protein and the same amount of animal source protein, such as meat, rats grow much faster on meat because it's a higher quality protein. And humans are not designed by nature to exist on a plant-only diet, although some cultures do subsist mostly on plant food. But the evidence suggests that humans are omnivores and they should consume at least some animal food. And if you can't, I wouldn't recommend consuming raw meat and fish because there's a risk of infectious disease. But if you can't handle dairy, I would stick with probably coconut and some cooked animal products such as meat and fish, cooked at moderate temperatures. There's a substantial chemical difference between animal products that are cooked at moderate temperatures, such as boiling or steaming, and animal products that are cooked at very high temperatures, like baking, roasting, grilling, etc. For example, carcinogens.
Yes, I'm glad you're going there.
There's a detectable level of carcinogens in meat that was cooked at very high temperature. For example, if it's fried meat, the temperature of cooking is around 300 degrees Celsius. I'm not sure about Fahrenheit. But in fried meat, there was detectable levels of carcinogens and mutagens, whereas in boiled meat or in steamed meat, these chemicals are almost undetectable. They are present at very low levels, which are probably not harmful at all. Yes, but I would try these animal products at low, cooked at moderate temperatures instead.
I so agree with you. Let's talk about GMO.
Genetically
modified.
Yeah, yeah. The current evidence suggests that there's no difference and there's no reason to be afraid of genetically modified food. And it's broken down into the same simple building blocks like amino acids, simple carbohydrates, vitamins, etc., as genetically unmodified food, so there is no reason to be afraid of it. And in my personal experience, there's no difference whether you consume modified or modified food,
mm-hmm.
or if you consume organic or food that is not organic, what really makes a difference is how you cook it and whether it contains any artificial ingredients, etc. But I wouldn't be afraid of genetically modified food or food that is not organic. There's no evidence that it causes any harmful effects on humans.
And we'll be back with more Inside Scoop Live after these important announcements.
Inside Scoop Live is a global internet-based broadcast specializing in interviewing published authors about their current books and areas of expertise. I'm Juanita Watson, the host of the show, and invite you to join me as I bring to the air both well-known and upcoming writers. You will hear my guests talk candidly about their books, their life experience, specific topics, and the business of being an author in today's literary world. Always interesting and current, my intention is to bring our audience high-quality discussions that spotlight a vast diversity of authors in the field today. Our interviews are syndicated and archived for availability 24/7 through direct podcast and MP3 download. And as always, I love to hear from listeners. Have a look at our website, InsideScoopLive.com. Send me an email, comment on previous guests, and let me know who you'd like to hear on the show. I'll do my best to bring you your favorite authors live and direct.
Welcome back to Inside Scoop Live. Wow. Isn't this an interesting topic? We are speaking today with Nikolai Shevchuk, and he is the author of How to Become Smarter. Hey, as you have heard so far, there is so much more to this book than just diet. There's research and much, much more. So let's continue with Nikolai. Nikolai, what about, you know, a chicken from the egg to the time that it is butchered and sold for consumption? Takes a matter of 6 weeks, which is not normal. And this is, you know, they're put into a cage. They have no outside existence. They're injected full of steroids so that there's that rapid growth. How do you feel about that, eating, consuming that kind of meat?
I'm fine with it. I've eaten this kind of meat all my life. I tried organic meat and grass-fed beef and farm fresh chicken, etc. There's no... At least subjectively, I cannot tell any difference.
Uh-huh.
And even in taste, there's sometimes the supermarket meat that was made with hormones and stuff, it tastes sometimes better than organic meat. And especially the organic brands of meat are low fat typically. And I try to avoid low fat meat because I don't think it's natural. I prefer meat that has normal amount of fat, and I do not worry about genetically modified organisms or hormones or how it was grown. It doesn't really make much difference because it's broken down in your digestive tract into exactly the same simple components during digestion. And you just get the same mixture of amino acids, you know, nucleotides, vitamins, simple carbohydrates as you would from meat that was injected with hormones or prepared with genetically modified feed, etc. I wouldn't worry about that.
The next thing I want to talk about is you talk about smart diets. And
uh-huh.
I'm wondering how you feel or if your research has given you any indication how important it is and when, say, a child growing up, when they should be fed, or is there anything in specific that they need to be fed so that their intelligence actually does grow because of what they eat rather than, you know, maybe from their genes? Did that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I got your question. There's some studies suggesting that infants, at least, if they are fed mother's milk, they attain higher IQ scores by about 5 points than infants that were fed artificial food such as baby formula. So this is breastfeeding children definitely should be good for their intelligence in the future. Regarding adolescents, and I'm not really an expert on child nutrition, but I would, and my book does not suggest that sticking with any particular diet for the rest of your life. I'm suggesting trying various smart diets. There are three different smart diets described in the book, temporarily on a need-to-use basis, and for most of your life, you can follow conventional food pyramids such as USDA's My Pyramid, or there's a good alternative, which is Harvard's Healthy Eating Pyramid. If you follow these guidelines, you should be okay in terms of your intelligence. And they were designed by experts in the field of nutrition, and they are based on totality of all available scientific evidence. So there are good nutrition habits for your everyday life. But sometimes, for example, if you need to enhance your attention, if you need to do a lot of reading, for example, you can switch to one of the diets described in my book, and this may be useful. Or, for example, if you want to entertain a group of people on some occasion, you may switch to a very low-protein diet, such as the fruit and vegetable diet, temporarily for a few days. And you may find it very easy to, you know, crack jokes and be very talkative and super active and not boring, so to speak. And afterwards, you can just switch to the normal diet recommended by food pyramids, and you will be okay. It's very difficult to determine what exactly is a natural diet of modern humans, because humans have coexisted with cooked food and some artificial ingredients for quite some time, and it's possible that at least substantial part of the population has adapted genetically to this kind of food, and some people function exceptionally well on the regular conventional diets recommended by food pyramids, and they don't need any smart diets, quote unquote. So it's hard to say, and it's hard to give any particular, you know, diet that will improve all your mental functions simultaneously for the rest of your life. Just my view, it's better to use certain lifestyle changes depending on circumstances. For most of the time, if you stick with dietary guidelines provided by the government, you should be okay.
Sure. So I just wanted to switch back, and we talked briefly about breastfeeding, and you say that that's an important part of the infant, but does that make a difference of what the mother eats also as to what the quality and what is in that milk?
Yes, in theory it should matter, but there's no, at least not, I'm not aware of any studies that would investigate the effect of mother's nutrition on the children's intelligence, so I can't really say. But if the mother leads a healthy lifestyle, she doesn't smoke, she doesn't drink, she adheres to dietary guidelines provided by the USDA's My Pyramid or Harvard's Healthy Eating Pyramid, and the child, at least she will do everything she can to make sure the child will grow up with good mental abilities. There's no hard research in this particular area, so it's difficult to speculate.
So, Nicola, how do you feel about supplements in the United States here? Some people feel that our earth is depleting. Our earth is depleting of nutrients that the vegetables and the fruits get from the soil to produce that fruit or vegetable. And in some cases, people believe that supplements are extremely necessary because we basically do not get what we really need out of these fruits and vegetables. What is your research, or what are your thoughts on that, on adding supplements? Feel it's necessary?
I don't think it's necessary. Some good studies conducted recently show that long-term multivitamin supplementation is not really necessary for people who consume a balanced diet recommended by government guidelines. The dietary supplements may be useful for people who consume a very deficient diet, But for average people who consume a balanced diet in developed countries, recent long-term studies show that there's no health benefit in that. So it's not really necessary in my view. And in some cases, vitamin supplements even turned out to be harmful. For example, if memory serves, some antioxidants increased the risk of lung cancer and worsened outcomes in some other, malignant tumors. So it's, and in theory, the dietary supplements are unusual types of food. I mean, no animal living in the wild consumes dietary supplements or food additives for that matter. So, and humans devised all these sophisticated chemicals introduced into their diet approximately several centuries ago, which is such a minuscule amount of time in terms of evolution. So I would say that the human brain is still not well adapted to the enormous amount of artificial chemicals that are currently present in human diet. But you shouldn't be afraid of them. I don't want to scare the listeners into following some strict diets which exclude all additives and stuff. My personal experience suggests that if you exclude all these artificial ingredients from your diet temporarily, you may experience some improvement in your mental abilities. But it's not really necessary long term. I mean, you will be fine if you do consume them. It's just important to realize that you may sometimes exclude them from your diet for your benefit, and you may benefit from you may experience a better mental functions as a result of this temporary exclusion, but you shouldn't be afraid to consume them if they are present in your diet, especially if they are recommended by your doctor. There's no need to be scared, but these chemicals, most of them have very subtle or non-existent effects on mental state or mental functions, and most of them are approved as safe by the government. So there's no reason to be scared of them. That's basically my opinion.
Yes, of course. And, gosh, Nikolai, I'm just looking at the clock, and it's we need to close. But before we do so, is there anything that you'd like to tell or say to our listening audience that we didn't cover? I mean, this could go on. We could go on for hours talking about this topic. And we certainly want the readers to check out your book called How to Become Smarter, and it is available on Amazon as well as your website, and we'll just go to that in a minute here. But before we do that, is there anything you'd like to just kind of find a final closing to our listeners?
There's some other interesting stuff in the book which has to do with cooling or heating of the body, which also has a number of effects on mental state and mental functions, which we did not discuss at length. But if I have a few minutes, I could talk about that if you want me to.
Yes, please do.
Okay. Yeah, sure. There's plenty of evidence that, for example, a brief moderate cooling of the body can have a stimulant effect on the central nervous system. It's been shown to reduce fatigue, to promote wakefulness, to elevate mood if it is normal. If mood is depressed, things are a little trickier. What else? Can also reduce pain. There's some also immunostimulatory effect. So this can be another interesting tool for you to enhance your mental abilities. And I describe a procedure called adapted cold shower, which is not stressful, as opposed to a sudden cold shower, and it's safe, according to a number of studies. In particular, some people believe that if they take a cold shower, they will come down with the flu or a cold, which is not true.
You know, I'm laughing because I remember my parents, and that's from that generation. It's like, you know, you wash your hair and you never go outside because you're going to catch a cold, and I could never get it how I can catch a cold with having a wet head. Anyway, go ahead. Continue.
Yes, it is true that respiratory infections predominantly occur during winter, and only recently we we have begun to understand why this may be the case. Some studies show that the survival and transmission of influenza virus is much better in cold, dry air. So this could be one reason. And another thing is that inhalation of cold air tends to suppress the immune system in the respiratory tract. So this could be another factor. So the inhalation of cold air is probably responsible for predominant occurrence of respiratory tract infections during the cold time of the year, but a cold shower has no effect on your respiratory tract, and you shouldn't be afraid, at least if you use the right temperature of the water, around 68 degrees Fahrenheit or 20 degrees Celsius. So that's one thing. And another thing, heating up the body is also a useful tool. For example, if you need to slow down, or if you have trouble falling asleep, some studies show that heating of the body can improve sleep. It can slow down mental processes. For example, if you're itching to do something that you know is unwise and you want to prevent yourself from doing something rash and stupid, I mean, you could try either taking a hot bath or increasing the environment temperature in your room or in your home. And this will slow you down and help you to get a hold of yourself, so to speak. It was also shown that both cooling and heating have a significant effect on mood. For example, the immediate effect of heating, it tends to lower mood, but you may experience a rebound after several hours. So this could be useful. And with cooling, it has been shown in several studies that it can immediately lift mood, and in people who have normal mood, and this can be useful in some creative activities. Elevated mood has been associated with increased creativity, increased generation of ideas and stuff. It is also associated with increased impulsivity, so there's a trade-off there. But in some situations, you could use these different tools, different diets, and different cooling or heating approaches, depending on circumstances. And you can change your activity level, your mood, to some extent, and you can change your you can control your impulses as well using these approaches. Some of this stuff has been tested in, I'm talking about healthy people mostly. Some of this stuff was tested in clinical trials with certain patients, but most of this evidence is from healthy people, and I can't really recommend this to patients, for example, ADHD patients or patients with depression. This hasn't been tested in clinical trials, and I can't really recommend that instead of available treatments. So I would recommend using conventional treatments, and if you're curious, you can give this a try, but do not put much faith into these techniques because they haven't been tested yet. But with respect to healthy people, there's plenty of evidence that these things can change attention, mood, sleep, etc. And all of this is described in the book, and there's some biological mechanisms that underlie these treatments. So there's an enumeration of empirical studies that support what I'm saying, and there's also a biological explanation for why this may be happening with your brain when you take a cold shower. Why would you experience elevation of mood? So the book goes into all these details, but it's written in a pretty accessible language, and most of this biological, scientific, technical discussion is put into endnotes, and you don't have to read this if you do not want to. So the book is pretty easy to read, at least from where I stand.
Thank you, Nikolai. And again, it's How to Become Smarter, and your website is myspace.com. Is that correct? next month.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Okay, so let me just, what I'm going to do is spell the name to the listeners. So they just go to myspace.com, and then it's Nikolai, Nikolai, underscore, Shavchuk, Shavchuk.
That is correct.
Good. Thank you again, Nikolai.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Listeners, there you have it. What an interesting conversation. Gosh, I hope that you were able to get your brain stimulated enough to check out Nikolai's book, How to Become Smarter. His scientific research certainly proves to what you really consume and internally really affect your brain functions. Again, Nikolai, gosh, thank you so much for taking the time to spend with us and phoning us all the way from Russia to give us such a delightful insight to how we can really increase our awareness as well as control our sleep and mood and tension and other functions just by what we eat and having that correct diet. I'm your host, Irene Watson. Thank you very much for listening. Bye for now.